Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy, and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million. Two questions with which to begin today. Number one, how does that happen? You get stuck sideways in the Suez Canal. Question number two, what do you do if you're the ship behind the one that got stuck? It is a supply chain kind of day today, gang. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Wednesday today, everybody, the 24th of March. Good as always to have you along. Our lead today comes to us courtesy of the Ever Given. That is a 1,300-foot long, 200-foot-wide container ship, one of the biggest of its kind, that is, as of this moment, most embarrassingly stuck, jamming up the Suez Canal. Nobody going north, nobody going south. One of the key routes of global trade basically closed. We have gotten Christine McDaniel on a Zoom to help us understand how this might play out. She's a senior research fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
So I have to tell you, the first thing I thought when I saw the pictures of this ship turned sideways in the canal, other than how the heck did that happen, was, wow, the global supply chain is really, really fragile if this can block up a major artery.
Yes, it is fragile. There's lots of moving parts. But remember, the global shipping industry, logistics, they are used to supply shocks, demand shocks, weather-related, war-related. So, you know, it's nothing they haven't dealt with before.
Fair enough. But if you are a tanker company looking at this traffic jam in the Suez Canal, how long are you going to wait and let your extremely valuable ship sit there in the backlog before you go around down the south of Africa and go the long way around?
Right. Well, economists, especially trade economists, have spent some time trying to calculate how much time costs in international trade. A couple economists estimated that each additional delay of shipping is equivalent to about 0.5% to up to 2% of a tariff. And then, of course, this is cascading because it's not just the stuff on that particular ship that's delayed, but then it's everything else that's getting delayed because of that.
Yeah, the issue here is downstream, right? I think this ship was supposed to go to Rotterdam, and you have to believe there's a bunch of companies in Rotterdam or elsewhere in Europe saying, where's my boat?
Right. Just about everything that gets made, you know, crosses at least a few borders. So, you know, it's not just a box of Kleenex or a particular component, you know, that might go into a car radio. So that car cannot be shipped until that car radio has all the components and is ready to go.
Well, so that gets me back to where I started. And you didn't much care for the question, right, about fragility. So let me rephrase it. It's a little bit tenuous sometimes, the global supply chain. Is that a more fair characterization?
Yeah, but I mean, I think it always has been. As manufacturers and producers try to decrease costs with just-in-time manufacturing, increase specialization, then yeah, every time there's a glitch, you know, there's going to be much bigger effects than we would have felt, you know, say 25 years ago or so when products weren't scattered so much across borders.
Christine McDaniel, she's a senior research fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason, talking about that ship that, as of this airing, is still stuck in the Suez Canal. Ms. McDaniel, thanks for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Kai.
Not only is it still stuck, by the way, they've given up until Thursday trying to get that thing loose. So that's what that is. Today in economic data points, moving on, orders for durable goods. Stuff that is supposed to last 3 years or more, that's machines, equipment, machines that make equipment, all that kind of stuff. Well, the Commerce Department says we bought less of all that in February. Durable goods orders down 1.1%, first time that has happened in almost a year. It would, I grant you, be cause for concern in normal times, but normal times these are not. Marketplace's Sabri Benishour has that one.
Tracy Vaught is opening a new restaurant this spring in the Houston area, so she's going to need to order a whole lot of stuff to make that happen.
Furniture, kitchen equipment, bar equipment, air conditioning.
Now, you know what she was not doing for part of February? Ordering that equipment.
You know, we didn't have any electricity for days.
Yeah, remember the storms that knocked out power, heat, and water to millions of people? They also dragged down the country's total durable goods orders for February. But there was even more weirdness.
There were a lot of distortion.
Gary Schlossberg is global strategist with the Wells Fargo Investment Institute. For example, new orders and shipments of motor vehicles and parts were both down about 9%.
That undoubtedly reflecting supply disruptions, the shortage of semiconductors.
U.S. automakers don't have enough semiconductors to make all the cars they want. And you can blame pandemic supply chain problems for that. But if you take silicon chips and bad weather out of the equation, things are actually looking all right. Samuel Coffin is a senior economist at UBS.
If you look at durable shipments over the past year, they're up 2% year on year, which is pretty good, you know, even with that February pause.
In recent Federal Reserve Bank surveys of manufacturers in the Philly and New York regions trickling in for March show really good growth.
I mean, the Philly Fed measure was at its highest level ever, except for 3 months in the early 70s.
So yeah, durable goods ahead are looking durable and good. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
Durable and good. On Wall Street today, it was a tale of three indices. A tiny little bit down, kind of medium down, and down hard. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Durable goods was today's economic indicator. Tomorrow's is going to be the final report on economic growth at the end of last year. Gross domestic product, October through New Year's, technically. And you'll notice I said final report because it will actually be the third look at that GDP data.
All data has revisions in this field, unfortunately.
Tovan Wachter is at UCLA. Now, why are there revisions? Well, take, for instance, another number we are going to get tomorrow, our regular Thursday reading on what will surely be stratospheric first-time claims for unemployment insurance.
UI agencies have been dealing with very large volumes, and so a small fraction of claims may not be immediately processed on the day that it is filed.
And lest you think these revisions, these adjustments to data are going to calm down once the pandemic is over?
I could see a world in where a lot of unemployed return to work either partially or with some breaks. And that may be just very hard to pick up in survey data.
Data. Tilvan Wachter there at UCLA. A couple of hundred companies signed a letter this week asking Congress to pass permanent paid family and medical leave, one of the critical solutions to our nation's economic recovery, they called it. You might not remember this, but right about this time last year, we were all busy doing other things, dealing with a pandemic. But this time last year, Congress did pass a law requiring a lot of businesses to offer 2 weeks of paid sick leave, 12 weeks of paid family leave for virus-related reasons. That, though, was temporary. Marketplace's Samantha Field looked into why businesses want government-sponsored family leave to be made permanent now.
One of the lines in the letter to Congress says, in short, paid leave is good for business. And it has been good for the multinational alcohol company Diageo, says HR executive Laura Watt.
It can help us attract great talent, and it really helps with retention.
2 years ago, Watt says, Diageo started offering 6 months of paid leave to all new parents.
And the feedback I got, people were just, they could not believe that we were being so progressive. They were talking about it to family, to friends, and it creates a huge amount of pride and loyalty to the organization.
Having federally mandated paid leave would help companies like Diageo that already offer it, and those that don't, says Annie Sarter at the advocacy organization Paid Leave for the U.S.
Big businesses support a federal policy because they know that it helps subsidize the cost of paid leave, so they embrace it. For small businesses, it helps them compete.
Over the past year, corporate support for family and medical leave has been building, says Vicky Shabo at New America.
We can no longer pretend that what happens at home is separate from what happens in our working lives.
Nearly 3 million women have dropped out of the labor market during the pandemic, and many are women of color.
This is a critical gender justice issue, a racial justice issue, and it would help bring women back into the workforce.
Shabo says paid leave is something Congress could make permanent as part of the next recovery package. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
You know how a lot of businesses had to change gears as the pandemic dug in? Same thing seems to be happening as this virus hopefully eases its way out. And takeout's a real good example. Demand for food delivery has, of course, exploded the past year, but it's almost certainly going to slow as more of us start eating out, actually in restaurants again. So delivery companies, and there is a boatload of them, are trying to find their way as consumers change their habits. Case in point, DoorDash. It's going to deliver at-home virus tests in selected cities, a big move away, one might say, from its core competency of, you know, delivering food. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab has that one.
Okay, let me take a deep breath here. DoorDash, Grubhub, Uber Eats, Seamless, Postmates, ChowNow, EatStreet, Delivery.com, Caviar. There are so many delivery apps. And Tom White at D.A. Davidson says not all of them will survive.
You're likely to see two big players that kind of dominate and use their scale to kind of block out smaller upstarts.
DoorDash is starting to separate itself as one of those players. Last month, it accounted for 55% of meal delivery sales, according to data from Second Measure. Scaling up could help solidify its spot as the leader, because Sunil Gupta at Harvard Business School says at the moment,
consumer loyalty is not very strong, so I don't care whether it comes through DoorDash or Uber Eats.
How do you make consumers care? Maybe you become the go-to for everything. Tacos, Tylenol, and COVID tests. And Gupta says that would help lock customers into unlimited delivery subscriptions. Most apps have them. Postmates, for instance, costs $99 a year. Because forget two-day shipping.
Think of them as becoming another version of mini Amazon. Now these players can become also the last mile delivery options.
And there's another big reason why these companies are looking beyond food. David Portalatin is with the NPD Group.
I haven't become aware of anybody that's actually making any money delivering food.
Restaurant and even grocery deliveries run on super tight profit margins. But a COVID test that will cost you $100 or so, that might leave DoorDash with a little more wiggle room. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
Three words, gang. Marketplace Morning Report. Check it out. Coming up.
I mean, it'll be kind of like a moment in history for them to own this thing.
I mean, maybe, but it is just a tweet, right? First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's down 3 points today, basically flat, 32,420. The NASDAQ plunged 265 points, that's 2%, 12,961. The S&P 500 down 21.5%, 38.89. Talked about stalled vessels in the Suez Canal need for worldwide shipping, so we'll ride the waves. Over to German shipping giant Hapag-Lloyd, which sputtered 3.7% today. The Danish firm Møller-Mærsk, for which my father worked low these many years ago, down 1.5% today. Sabri was talking about durable goods orders, down in February, thanks in part to severe weather last month. Orders for planes way up, cars fell, but Boeing still descended 0.8%. In the auto lane, General Motors downshifted about 0.6%. Bond prices rose. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note fell to 1.61%. You're listening to Marketplace.
And now a word from our sponsors at Betterment. Do you want your money to dream big? Do you want your money to be a total self-starter? Are you annoyed that your money doesn't work hard enough? Don't worry. Betterment is here to help. Betterment is the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Their automated technology is built to help maximize returns, meaning when you invest with Betterment, your money can auto-adjust as you get closer to your goal, rebalance if your portfolio gets too far out of line, and your dividends are automatically reinvested. That can increase the potential for compound returns. In other words, your money is breaking a sweat while you can be breaking bread. You'll never picture your money the same way again. Betterment, the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Visit Betterment.com to get started. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. I don't know if you remember this, but it became really clear in the early to middle stages of this pandemic, when that flash recession that we had was kind of at its worst, that there were some serious structural problems in this economy that were being laid bare. The racism, for one, inequity more broadly, and also just our systems, the gears of it. For a full year now, states have been dealing every single week with more first-time claims for unemployment benefits than at any point in the Great Recession. Millions of people who've lost their jobs are still collecting benefits, and because of that, state unemployment systems are deeply, deeply stressed. So some of those states are trying to change things, most specifically the rules to get benefits and the taxes on businesses that pay for them. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports on how that is playing out in the state of Washington.
Business is starting to get back to normal at Well 80, a brew pub in Olympia, Washington, the state capital.
Professionals at work.
Owner Chris Knudsen sits at an outdoor table on the patio. He's now allowed to have indoor seating as well at 50% capacity.
We're really strict with mask wearing. Half of my job now is just walking around telling people they need to put their masks on.
Way better than a year ago, when Knudsen suddenly had no dine-in customers and hardly any revenue after Washington ordered its first lockdown.
When we first had to close down, we basically had to lay everybody off, almost our entire workforce.
About 25 bartenders, servers, cooks, and dishwashers.
It's been really tough for a lot of them. You know, fortunately, most of them have been able to get unemployment.
But that wave of unemployment claims led to a big problem for Knudsen and other business owners who laid off their workers.
Geez, our insurance premiums are going to go way the heck up.
He means unemployment insurance premiums, the taxes employers pay into the state trust fund that pays jobless benefits. The more workers an employer lays off, the higher its premium. Republican State Senator Curtis King says businesses like Knudsen's faced a huge spike in their unemployment taxes.
You know, in some cases, 1,000% increase. You have businesses all around the state that are just hanging on by the skin of their teeth, doing everything they possibly can to keep their doors open.
To help them, King co-sponsored legislation that defers those taxes. For a while, anyway, Washington still needs to replenish its unemployment trust fund, which is down by about two-thirds since the pandemic hit. Democratic State Senator Karen Kaiser was the prime sponsor of the law.
We are looking at a bit of an economic rebound, so that will help because the Microsofts and Amazons and Costcos of the world are still paying their premiums as normal.
At the same time, the law raises the state's minimum unemployment benefit by about 35% to $270 a week, which Kaiser says is only fair.
If we were going to give much over $1 billion in tax breaks for business, we should also help the poorest workers.
Washington's not the only state trying to reform its unemployment system. Legislators in Vermont are considering a bill that would add a benefit for dependent children. A bill in Colorado would allow undocumented workers to receive jobless benefits. Other states are contemplating cutting benefits, including West Virginia, Tennessee, Ohio, Kansas, and Arizona. A bill in Florida would tax online shoppers to refill the unemployment trust fund, sparing employers a big tax hike. At Well 80 Brew House in Olympia, Washington, it's Tuesday trivia night, and Chris Knudsen's pumping up the crowd.
We have back with us tonight Quiz Khalifa. Quiz Khalifa is here with their 10 points. Nice job, you guys.
For the first time since the pandemic hit, people are playing in the restaurant, watching on the big screen TVs. Knudsen says he's grateful to have most of his workers back from unemployment now and to be getting some relief on his upcoming unemployment tax bill.
Without government assistance, we wouldn't be here anymore. And I think that's true of most restaurants. And where I hear, there's, you know, people aren't working.
With a brew pub nearly half full of people eating and drinking, Knutson says he's feeling pretty comfortable about the future. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Earlier this week, Jack Dorsey, the co-founder and CEO of Twitter, sold the first ever tweet, his as it happens, for $2.9 million, which he then said he would donate to charity, to be clear. He sold it as an NFT, that's short for non-fungible token. We've been talking about them for a couple of weeks now. Digital, I mean, I guess you'd call them assets that represent something, digital art, a trading card. We talked about NBA Top Shot. Anyway, a digital asset that is stored on the blockchain. Lots of people way less well-known than Jack Dorsey are trying to sell their tweets as NFTs now. And there has been talk about whether they are here to stay, these NFT things, or whether they're just a fad. So we decided to run a little tweet NFT selling experiment.
I am Andrew. I do culture stuff at Scent.
Scent makes valuables. It's a platform that people use to sell their tweets as NFTs. It's been around a little less than 4 months. It's where Jack Dorsey sold his tweet. So I figured, good enough for Jack, good enough for me. And I started sharing my screen with Andrew to get some help with this whole thing. There we go. All right. So I'm in this thing called MetaMask. What do I do now if I want to do, as we are hoping to do with this story, take one of my tweets, and we'll get to that in a minute, and actually get it out there in NFT land? How do I do this?
Love it. Okay. So MetaMask is like not our product. This is the crypto fun part. So let's see. Let's get started.
Okay. Getting started. I set up my digital wallet. That's the crypto fun part where you actually get the money if your tweet sells. I browsed around a little bit to see what random tweets were going for. Some from people I had heard of, others not. Some for $5 bids, others for a couple of hundred. I did eventually get around to uploading my own tweet, one in which I said something you have probably heard me say a time or two.
And which, this is your first tweet? Or what
this is
this
my
one?
First tweet in which I said the stock market is not the economy. So on April 29th, 2009, I responded to somebody. I responded to a news station, actually, and I said, number one, they asked, you know, any tips or advice to people who are reading along in the markets with us. And I said, number one, listen to Marketplace. Number two, the Dow is not the economy, and the economy is not the Dow. And number three, I said, take what public officials say with a grain of salt, which is good advice in any instance. Okay. Now that we're here, though, and I've got my tweet that I want to, you know, put up there, what do I do?
So you got to log into this. Uh-huh. Valuables with your Twitter first. So see that gray circle on the top right?
Gray circle on oh, yeah.
And sign in.
Oh, sign in. Gotcha. Okay. Am I in? I'm in. Oh, look. There we go. Okay. Yep.
So now basically, we just verified that this is your tweet. You are allowed to sell this.
Gotcha. All right.
Wow.
Holy cow. Look at this.
So now what you do is you just click tweet it, and you'll let everybody know, hey, this is up for sale.
Wow. Wow. So this is it. I'm going out to the marketplace, as it were, pun intended, with this tweet.
Yep.
So let me ask you. So before I hit this, which somehow seems monumental, although I don't know why, then what happens?
We'll have a pre-populated tweet. It will say something corny like, hey, this tweet's for sale, everybody, and then you can change the text if you want. I mean, like you're going to put your autograph on this tweet. So for anybody right. that values what you say here, I mean, it'll be kind of like a moment in history for them to own this thing.
Wow. I'm all of a sudden a little hesitant, and I can't understand why. Maybe I'm a little worried that it's not going to fetch a decent price, although I have no idea what this tweet is worth. Do you wonder if Jack Dorsey had this probably going through his mind? Probably not.
He probably just saw it and was just like, oh, sweet. Boom.
Yeah, right? All right. Well, look, I guess we're just going to do this. I did change that pre-populated tweet, though. I mean, come on. So trying a thing. We all know the stock market is not the economy. I've been saying it for a while. Question is, how much is that worth? Put a question mark question on the question. Mark. There yes. you go. There you go. Everybody needs a copy editor. Okay, here we go. Hitting reply. And this one's going out into the Twitterverse.
Ta-da!
So it's out there. I'm in the market with this tweet. How long should I wait and just leave it up there? Or at some point, am I going to get embarrassed by, you know, people paying a buck and a half for my tweet and I take it down? I mean, what are the mechanics here?
Yeah, it's totally up to you. There is no time limit. You just kind of sit back and wait for people to make offers. I'll put a few offers in to give
no,
it a
no, 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 no. Let's make this real. Let's make this real.
But yeah, I mean, it's like, it's totally up to you to accept an offer or never accept any offers if you don't want to. I mean, this is the IP part of it. So if you don't want to give it away, don't give it away. If you do, if you find somebody that likes it, then send it to them.
Yeah. Now, how do I get to a place where I can see what the bids are, if the bids are anything?
Go to your profile on the left and then.
No offers yet. Gotcha.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, Andrew, look, thank you. I really appreciate you bearing with me as I work through this, on the air, as it were. And we'll see what happens with this thing. We'll let you know.
Cool. It's been fun. Thank you for having me.
The latest bid on my first stock market is not the economy tweet. $50. And I should say, by the way, that wherever this thing lands, the money goes to Marketplace, not to the Kai Ruzdahl Friday Afternoon Beer Fund. This final note on the way out today, I do try to make note of this every year, and this year is certainly no year not to. You might have heard today is Equal Pay Day, the day of the current year until which women have to work to earn what a white man earned in the prior year. That is for all women, though. For black women, Equal Pay Day is August 3rd. Native American women, September the 8th. Latinas, October the 21st. All right, we got to go. Here is your very quick moment of economic context. It's an addendum of sorts to the final Mother's Equal Pay Day in this economy. Moms, June the 4th. Doesn't make any sense. None of this makes any sense. Our media production team is Brian Allison, Robin Edgar, Drew Jostad, Garrett Lang, Jeff Peters, Jay Sebold, Liana Squilacci, Charlton Thorpe, Ben Holliday, and Becca Weinman. They, of course, are the ones coming to the studio, so the rest of us don't have to. Most of the rest of us. We have better internet. I'm Kai Ruzdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.